Hey, before we get started with today's episode, we want to say thank you to everyone who's helping to grow our podcast. Please keep sharing with your friends and follow Crime Off the Grid on Facebook and at Crime Off the Grid Podcast on Instagram. Hey there. If you like true crime stories and you love being in the great outdoors, you have come to the right place. I'm Tara, your host. Welcome to Crime Off the Grid. Welcome everybody to the Crime Off the Grid podcast. And if this is your first time listening, we talk about true crime stories from national parks and forests and other off-the-grid places. And all of our guests and co-hosts have years of experience as law enforcement officers, special agents, prosecutors, or victim specialists in wild places. So speaking of experienced guests, I want to introduce someone who holds lots of credentials and has a lot of experience in bringing a lot of offenders to justice in national parks and other remote places. And I feel very fortunate that Brian Smith is with us today to talk about a notorious case that he has firsthand knowledge. Brian has 27 years of National Park Service experience, 15 years at the Port Angeles Police Department. From Marin County, California, he started in 1981 at Golden Gate National Recreation Area, later Sequoia National Park, Glen Canyon National Recreation Area, Grand Canyon National Park, which is what we're talking about today, Yosemite National Park. He was an instructor at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. He worked at Yellowstone National Park and the Washington office for the National Park Service. Roles he held were U.S. Park Ranger, Supervisory Park Ranger, Special Agent, Supervisory Agent, and retired in 2008 as the Investigative Services Branch Intermountain Region Special Agent in Charge. Brian joined the Port Angeles Police Department in 2008 as Deputy Chief and was appointed Chief of Police in 2016. He has a Bachelor's in Political Science from UC Berkeley, a Master's in Public Administration from Montana State University, and from the FBI National Academy, he was a graduate at the 214th session. He's married to Kristen Faye Smith, who is also a legendary U.S. Park Ranger. Yes, she is. Hey, Brian, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. I feel really honored to have you here today.
It's great to see you, Tara, and it's great to be able to talk to you.
Well, also, you did some work on a Hulu documentary. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So the season 2 of Wild Crime involved a case at Yosemite National Park that spanned over 40 years. And it was a homicide case, and it was it's an amazing story about rangers and special agents and people who persevered. And I helped the producers only, and I had some background, and I'd worked with a lot of people involved, and I had some involvement in some similar cases. So I didn't have a very big part of it, except I got to be in the series, and people who knew me saw it and would comment about seeing me in it. And my experience with that was I was very impressed with the producers and how they covered that story and the actual story, which involved friends of mine and colleagues, people I really, you know, love and care about. I was just blown away at their story and how it was told.
Yeah,
Wild Crime, and actually season 1 as well, featured another person that I'd worked with who I greatly admire. And that was also an amazing story. I wasn't involved in that one, but those seasons of Wild Crime I thought were just, you know, absolutely amazing.
Yeah, if you haven't had a chance to watch Wild Crime on Hulu, the 2 seasons, I highly recommend it, and you get a really good taste of what rangers and agents in the National Park Service actually do. So, highly recommended. The case we're going to talk about today is about one of the best-known fugitive criminals who received widespread attention and notoriety from the time of his escape from the Florence State Prison in Arizona on May 12th in 1992. Danny Ray Horning received various nicknames during his time as a fugitive, such as Robin Hood, for some reason, and even called a real-life Rambo for his so-called survival skills as he escaped the high security guarded prison and was able to survive for nearly 2 months, around 7 weeks, I guess, eluding over 400 police officers in the wilderness of Arizona forests and Grand Canyon National Park. Horning was a danger to the public and to the teams of officers who pursued him for nearly 2 months. And in this case, there's been a lot of articles as well as a documentary or two, including FBI files, which I just watched the other day. And I found it interesting and frustrating that the significant involvement and contribution and expertise provided by the National Park Service Rangers is not even mentioned. So fortunately, we have you here today, Brian, because you were in Grand Canyon at the time and have firsthand knowledge about this case.
Of course.
But I'm going to get us started here with the details of this story prior to your involvement, Brian, which the story begins September 1990, when a man named Mark Lawson was fishing on the banks of the San Joaquin River near Stockton, California. He was on a little stretch of river called the Burns Cut, and Lawson cast his line and came up with a large black garbage bag, and as he pulled the bag out of the river, he opened it up and found a freshly severed human leg. So, of course, Lawson freaks out and runs to call the police. And I'm assuming, well, he had to drive somewhere to get to a phone, which is probably why the deputies didn't come until the next morning. So San Joaquin County Sheriff's Department showed up and they scoured the banks on foot, dredged the river by boat, and they found yet another garbage bag containing two severed arms bound together with duct tape. They continued searching, and they found a human torso that was wrapped in a bed sheet. And then they found a freely floating human head. Oh, and with the torso, they also found a pair of pants, some other clothing, a wallet, and a serrated steak knife. And they think maybe it's possibly what was used to dismember the body at this point. Now the body goes to a medical examiner, turning up some major clues. First, they get fingerprints from the body, and that does match the identity found on the wallet's driver's license, which that needs to be verified because just because you found the wallet and a driver's license doesn't mean that that is actually who whose body you have. He had also been killed with a .22 caliber bullet that they found lodged in his brain, and it was fired into his forehead point blank. And yes, the serrated knife that was found was, in fact, the knife used to dismember the body. The deceased's name was Sammy McAuliffe, who was a local catfish farmer and a well-known marijuana dealer. And with a full-blown murder investigation underway, the deputy sheriff, whose name is Armando Meoya, took the role of the lead investigator, and he was immediately shocked to learn of a crime of this nature could have happened in his own hometown. So the police go to the deceased McAuliffe's home, and then they learned that he drove a white Jeep Cherokee, which they soon found abandoned. And then they also noticed that the Jeep was really, really clean and had been recently scrubbed out in the interior, and the floor mats were still wet from somebody washing them out. Police also learned how McAuliffe's body may have ended up in the river. Fortunately, there was a man named James Castro who was down by the river that night the body was dumped. And Castro was camping on the banks of the Burns Cut area. And at one point, he noticed a white Jeep Cherokee driving back and forth along the cut. And when the car stopped by the river, Castro heard like cracking and stomping sounds in the bushes and brushes. And then he hears splashes in the water like someone was dumping a load of junk or something into the river. And from Castro's statement, police pretty much surmised that McAuliffe's killer dismembered the dead body, transported the remains using his own Jeep, and dumped the body near Burns Cut campsite. And as the investigation continues, they learn that many of McAuliffe's possessions were missing, including his already recovered Jeep Cherokee. He was missing two shotguns, a revolver, and a 9mm semi-auto pistol. And when they were going through McAuliffe's home, it was really, really clean. But despite the home's clean appearance, detectives went over it with a fine-tooth comb, searching for like the slightest disturbance that might shed light on how the murder went down. And they noticed in the drain of the bathtub, there was something catching the light that was a little bit shiny, and they found a small fragment of human bone. And as they probed deeper, the detectives discovered blood and human tissue caught in the trap. And they saw that in the kitchen, a cutlery set was missing one piece, which was missing a steak knife. And I have to say that if someone comes in my kitchen and sees my knives, they're going to go, there must have been a lot of murders because none of these knives match. And they're missing all kinds of knives. But this guy had a full set. He had one knife missing. And the set matched the serrated knife found in the river with the body. And detectives were all but certain that McCullough's murder happened here in his own home, his body dismembered in his own bathtub using a steak knife from his own kitchen. So with no other leads to follow from the Burns cut or McCullough's home, the police dug into McCullough's personal history. And then they turned up where McCullough seemed to have been a target and a victim more than once in the past. So as McCullough was known as a drug dealer, he kept a lot of cash around the home, which made him a frequent target of burglaries committed by what I read were referred to as Stockton's lowlifes. And most notably, McCullough was robbed at gunpoint at his home about 2 years before his murder. And the police arrested and charged someone named Stephen Horning with the crime, who was one of five Horning brothers, and they all lived in San Joaquin County. Now they're thinking that McCullough's murder may have been a revenge killing. So detectives went to see Stephen Horning's older brother, Timothy, who was a local security guard, and he was the easiest one of the Horning brothers to track down. So Timothy Horning told the authorities that Stephen and his brother, Danny Ray Horning, were practically inseparable. They did everything together. And when deputies mentioned the Burns Cut area, Timothy says, oh yeah, that's our old hunting and fishing grounds. So the police learned where Stephen and Danny Ray lived, which is in a trailer behind their parents' house in Stockton. And I was going to ask you, Brian, what would have been your first guess? Because my first guess would have been like in the basement of the parents' home. but a trailer behind their parents' house would be my second guess. They managed to get a search warrant. No one was at the trailer, but the detective searched the yard nearby. And in the grass next to the trailer, they found a Western Field .22 caliber rifle broken into two pieces. And remember the .22 caliber bullet retrieved from McCullough's brain. So this is potentially the murder weapon. Detectives found Stephen Horning, and then they interrogated him. Stephen gave up additional details about the Hornings' dealings with Sammy McCullough. Stephen said he had actually taken the fall for the robbery and served the time, which also involved Danny Ray. Ultimately, sent Stephen to prison, Danny Ray vowed to kill McCullough for turning in his brother. So it's interesting to me that Stephen Horning is telling the detectives the stuff about his brother that he was apparently so inseparable with. Danny Ray was unable to carry out his initial threat as he went to prison himself following his conviction on charges of child molestation. So the victim here was his own six-year-old daughter. Horning was released on parole in June of 1990, 3 months before McCullough's murder. And I have to ask, why would you release a child molester on parole? Why at least can't they fulfill their sentence? Oh, and here's a fun fact. Brother Timothy described Danny Ray as especially adept at butchering animals, and he once saw Danny dismember a deer in the bathtub, meticulously clean up the blood, place the deer's meat and body waste in trash bags. And those details are hauntingly similar to that of McCullough's murder. The Horning's father also, I mean, this family just gives each other up. The Horning's father also divulged a particularly disturbing story about his two inseparable sons. And I hate to even say this story, but I felt like it was important. But one day while hanging out in the yard with family, Danny Ray and Stephen decided to use the family dog as target practice. And Danny Ray mercilessly fired a fatal round into the dog's head while Stephen shot at it with his crossbow. The two men just laughed about what they did to their poor dog, and they buried the dead dog in the grass next to their trailer. So the cops found the dog's grave and dug out the bullet used to kill the dog. And what do you know? It was a .22 caliber bullet. Well, deputies were unable to track down Danny Ray's whereabouts, and the case turned cold. So I'm going to fast forward. On March 22nd, 1991, Danny Ray Horning was in Winslow, Arizona. He walked into the Valley National Bank and committed armed robbery with a 9mm pistol. As the teller filled the bag with $25,000 in cash, she secretly tripped the silent alarm, and unbeknownst to Horning, an SOS went immediately to the Winslow Police Department, which was just one block's distance from the bank. So the officers responding got there within 2 minutes of the call. And I actually like this part of the story. As the lead detective approaches the bank's front door, he could see Horning as Horning was backing up toward the door with his arm around a hostage, and he reached the doorway. Horning released the hostage and pushed through the door, and he stepped onto the sidewalk only to find the detective's handgun pressed to his ribs. And the detective took Horning's gun and a bag of cash and pushed him up against the wall and placed him under arrest. And that, to me, sounds almost like an episode of Gunsmoke and Marshall Dillon. But the Winslow robbery case went to trial, and Horning was found guilty of armed robbery, assault, and kidnapping. Following Horning's arrest and conviction in Winslow, the state of California declined to extradite him for the McAuliffe murder and dismemberment case. And from the slew of charges pressed on Horning for robbery and kidnapping, etc., it was imminent he would face a long sentence in an Arizona prison. And I kind of get that with Horning in prison in Arizona. Maybe it would buy them some time to get their case a little more ironclad in San Joaquin County. At sentencing, Horning practically dared the judge to give him the maximum sentence possible. Horning vowed to escape, even if locked down under maximum security, and bragged that he would be out within months, no matter how long they intended to keep him, which to me sounds like Ernest E. Bass breaking out of the Mayberry Jail. I don't know if you're familiar with Ernest E. Bass, Brian. Probably yes. Not, huh? Okay.
Oh, yeah, I remember the character.
Yeah, always breaking out of jail and throwing rocks. Anyway, so the judge was like, oh, yeah, hold my beer, and handed him 4 consecutive life sentences to be served in Arizona's Florence State Prison. Now in prison, Danny gets a job as a janitor, and he regularly cleans both the infirmary and the kitchen. And he was often left unattended or in the company of other inmates with no guards around when he was working. So much for high security. In the kitchen, he gets a pair of white pants from another inmate. And then from the infirmary, he stole a white lab coat. So now he's all dressed in different clothes. And along the way, he finds an employee ID that was carelessly left out in the open. And so he swiped that. And now he's got a disguise and a method to get out of there, so he escapes, walking right out the door. And within a few days of the escape, it became the largest and most time-consuming manhunt in Arizona history.
Well, Sarah, okay, I'll pick up the story from there. And it's got a month and a half of a number of twists and turns, and a manhunt that I would describe it sort of evolves from a slow burn to a full wildland fire. Mm. And, you know, I'm not involved at this point, but what I remember reading, what I've heard, was initially the Arizona Department of Corrections has a fugitive, and they deploy a response, you know, which would include canine and working with local law enforcement and a search area of some kind. I don't remember when the media coverage started, but you have to set the stage here for 1992. We're a few years away from widespread use of the internet. Most people are going to get their news from TV or reading a newspaper.
Right.
Law enforcement, you know, I have there no evidence that law enforcement, mainstream law enforcement, is using anything like incident command. So how these responses and searches would be carried out would be something that would look nothing like how we would do them today. So that's how it starts. And the fugitive goes throughout Arizona. He goes as far as down as Tucson. He goes back to Winslow. He goes up to the Mañon Rim, sort of central Arizona. He commits another bank robbery during this fugitive stage. And he only gets a small amount of money. I think it's $2,300. He's spotted repeatedly by law enforcement. And he escapes. He commits burglaries. he steals a 44 Magnum pistol, which will come into the story, or revolver, not pistol. That'll come into the story later. And he does things like leave notes apologizing to people and has some evidence that he's bold and aggressive and is willing to, you know, to operate out in the woods away from things. Mm-hmm. And he's very opportunistic from an offender profile. I'd say this is a very opportunistic, very clever offender. Not a Rambo, certainly not a Robin Hood, but somebody who's, you know, enjoying the attention. And you know, when you leave people a note after you've broken into their cabin,
right,
it will get the media's attention. So mm-hmm. early May, this is happening, and it's getting more and more attention in the news. The governor of Arizona issues some kind of emergency declaration to fund a search. So where I'm in the story is I'm a supervisor on the South Rim. It's the beginning of summer. It's busy. I'm barely paying attention to the story. Some of the members of my patrol team are actually paying more attention, and we talk about it a little bit, but I'm not really paying attention. I mean, a lot of things happen that never affect you. So
right.
I'm just aware of it. I think I could have been able to say the name of the guy at this point. So the story moves into the Flagstaff area. And by then, there's been numerous near misses of catching him. He's committed a host of crimes. He hasn't been very successful, but he's still on the run. So we'll go up to June 25th, where he is in Flagstaff, Arizona. If you've been to Flagstaff, it's a historic town, tourist place. It's got an interstate, railroads. It's kind of a crossroads of travel, and it's now I think a city of about 70,000. It was probably a city of 40,000 then. So he hatches a plan to kidnap people and take hostages, and his initial ideation, I guess you would say, doesn't work out. So he moves to another part of Flagstaff, and I've read this that he's trying to figure out how to get a vehicle, and he's looking for something, and he believes a police officer sees him and recognizes him. So you got to remember, he's been spotted by law enforcement a number of times where they do actually recognize him, and they pursue him, and he gets away. In this case, there's no evidence that the Flagstaff officer recognizes him. He would just look like another person. But,
right.
But he believes the officer might have recognized mm-hmm. him. So he sees smoke coming from a place. He goes into a hotel, has the desk clerk call 911 to create a diversion, believes that he hears sirens responding, and then he hatches his plan that is going to involve me. Now, we know some of this because he talked later. He gave statements.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to remember some of what he says may not be true, or may be his perception.
Right.
So I'm mixing some of the stuff I've read and some of the stuff that I think is probably accurate. But the part I remember from a Coconino County Sheriff's detective is that he walks up to two people, and they're described as a couple, but as I remember it, it's actually a business owner and her employee, and they're on the street in Flagstaff, and he walks up to them, and the detective tells me that our offender points this 44 at them and says, "Hi, I'm Dan Horning." Not I'm Danny Ray Horning, but I'm Dan Horning, as if they're supposed to know who
that
is.
Yeah.
Right. So he takes them hostage. They're in a Ford Taurus, and So he takes them hostage. He has them drive towards Williams, Arizona. Some things happen. He forces one to withdraw money. I seem to remember they went down as far as Kingman, but I can't find that in the telling of the story. But they wind up that night at the Altavar Hotel at the South Rim of the Grand Canyon. So our offender has hatched a scheme at this point. He's going to kidnap a family who have money, and he's going to ransom them for like over $1 million. And he's going to do that at the Grand Canyon. And again, what I remember about reading and the investigation was he believed he could also get one of his brothers out of jail. And
right.
They could take this family and this motorhome to Mexico. That was all part of this plan. So,
right. So he thought that maybe by kidnapping essentially a prominent family, that he could be used as leverage to get his brother out.
Right. So that's in his mind. He's imagined
this plan
is going to work. you know, it's not a plan that he's done any real research on would actually work. You know, and he doesn't have right. he doesn't have modern tools where you could look up on, you could Google search, you know, best ways to kidnap people and get ransom.
Right, right.
There's yeah. no YouTube videos available for him at this point. So
yeah.
he cooks up this plan. And some of this we know because when he gets to the El Tovar Hotel, they rent a room. And again, what I remember is that he forces the hostages to sleep. This doesn't sound right, but again, I read this that like in the closet, and he's narrating some kind of recorded manifesto that mm-hmm. he's gonna provide later while they're, you know, in the closet. And again, I've read this, but I don't remember this from the report. He actually leaves them in the room and they stay there, and he goes and scouts out a place in the South Rim Village near Babbitt's store. And he spots this large trailer. I thought it was a motorhome, but it's described as a trailer. He believes that that will be the object of his next stage of his crime spree. Now, there's nobody with it. So, again, this is stuff people do that doesn't make any sense. He would have no idea knowing when they're going to come back. So they're not there. So he decides that he's going to go retrieve his hostages, return to that location, and wait for them. So think about all the possibilities here. They're on a right. backcountry trip, you know, they're gone for 5 days. Who knows when they're coming back? But they do come back. And so he's now at the Babbitt store, and I'll just stop for a second. The Grand Canyon Village is one of our more developed park areas. At night, it's a community of over 10,000 people. It's probably closer to 15,000 with yeah. hotels, campgrounds. It's a mm-hmm. large residential area. It's got a large store, post office, bank. Hotel complexes, you know, it covers several miles.
Right. Schools, medical clinic, community center.
You'd call it a small town in the middle of a national park in late June, June 25th. It's highly populated. The parking lot at Babbitt's store would be full, and it would look like, you know, a smaller version of the parking lot at Old Faithful.
You know, yeah, I'm so fascinated on how in the world they managed to get a room at the El Tovar Hotel. Right.
So they got a room at the El Tovar. They move. And my memory tells me this is June 27th, but everything I've read tells me it's June 26th. So we'll call it June 26th. Okay. So at this point, the Grand Canyon the Park Service has districts and sub-districts, but the South Rim traditionally has called the two patrol operations South Rim Patrol. And we're really proud of that distinction. So we're called South Rim Patrol. There's a day shift and a night shift, like you would see in other parks like Yosemite and Old Faithful at Yellowstone. But so my team is what we call summer night shift. So in March, we switch from day shift to night shift. And this is a Friday night. It's June, and I'm rarely off on a Friday night, but I'm off this Friday night, and I'm the shift supervisor. And my new assistant shift supervisor is Dan Kirshner. He's also off that night. And you, of course, know Dan. You work with him at Yellowstone, mm-hmm. legendary ranger and special agent.
Yes.
So Dan and I are the only two off, but there's five other law enforcement rangers on duty this Friday evening, and it's dusk. I remember that clearly because I heard the first radio call. So it's not quite dark, but it's dusk. Ranger Don Miller, who's also a legendary ranger, is in a marked patrol car. He's in a 1990 Chevy Caprice, you know, full cruiser, and he's driving. And this is from Don telling me this and me reading the report, slowly across the parking lot at Babbitt's store when he's approached on foot by a young man who's saying things to him that it's sort of hard to take in all at once. But the gist of it is that he's got a gun and he's kidnapping my family and he's over there. That's the gist of what's happening.
Yeah.
So what has happened is that this family has returned to this trailer and motorhome, and our offender has approached them ostensibly to look at the trailer, to buy it. And he separated the father from the group, and the rest of them are standing around when I believe this young man discovers that his dad's being held at gunpoint.
by our offender. And he sees the patrol vehicle, the marked unit. So he runs a distance away, approaches him, and tries to tell him excitedly about this crime that's happening. And so Ranger Don Miller is taking all this in as he's driving, you know, slowly in the direction of what he reports is just a group of people standing around. I read a couple of versions of this that add information that I never got from the reports, and I never heard it from Don in person. So there's some details that I read, and I'm like, I don't remember any of that. So I'll just tell you the part that I, you know, that I got from Don and the Rangers and what I read. So as Don gets close enough to see what's going on, our offender all of a sudden draws this 44 Magnum handgun and points it right at Don. And Don has, you know, a number of seconds to react. He puts the vehicle in park. He reaches for a shotgun, and the subject uses that pause to jump into his vehicle. Now, the vehicle contains those two hostages that have been with him since yesterday. So he exits the parking lot. His hostages are in the back seat. So picture Old Faithful parking lot full of cars and people. That's what you're looking at.
Thousands of people everywhere.
Yeah, people everywhere. So Don gives pursuit in his vehicle. And the only prelude warning to this was radio traffic from Don. And I heard him say it on the radio that I'm either responding to or I'm checking out a report of a man with a gun at Babbitt's. So that's the words I remember Don saying. And so what I heard, you know, in Arizona, people open carry guns. Like, I heard it as, okay, there's somebody walking around carrying a gun.
Right.
Like, not uncommon. Now, that's not exactly what it was. And Don's got, like, this is, the kid has run up to him, excitedly telling him, he's driving towards it, and he says that on the radio. I'm investigating, or I'm responding to a report of a man with a gun at Babbitt's. The next thing that happens is Don reports that he's in pursuit. So now we have this really wild chase that starts. Now, our offender has been on the run for a month and a half. He's had, I'd say, good luck to this point. But now his luck's going to change.
Right.
He's in a location where there's five on-duty law enforcement rangers, four patrol cars, and one of them's a double unit. And they're within a half a mile of each other. And they're all on duty, and they're all there. So with Don reporting that he's in pursuit, this pursuit drives through past the Yavapai Hotel, crosses the street into the headquarters, visitor center, Shrine of Ace complex. The program is just letting out. So there's people on foot everywhere. There's cars everywhere.
Yeah, so like the interpretive, led program. Yeah.
Interpretive led program is letting out. And so this chase enters that parking lot, and something I read said he drove through a ditch and around the parking lot. I don't think that's true. Mm. He literally just drove through the parking lot that was full of cars and people. Well, the proximity of the other Rangers, I watch Chris Forbes and John Piastic like jog to their patrol car from the first call from the neighborhood that I live in. And they're already to the pursuit at this point. That's how close all this is. So as he's exiting the parking lot, if I can paint the picture, John Piastic is driving, Chris Forbes, both two legendary Rangers, and Chris later a special agent. They're, as pursuits happen, they're driving right into it as he comes out of the parking lot with Ranger Don Miller like behind him in pursuit. So our offender decides that what he needs to do is take his 44 Magnum, and he's moving at this point. He takes it, and I believe he's right-handed, and fires over his shoulder at close range at John and Chris as they pass. They're trying to stop, I think, but they pass each other traveling the opposite direction. So we lost all the radio traffic, unfortunately. So this is all from what people remember. We didn't get the radio recorded. So, I mean, I'm at this point, I'm already trying to get to my residence and suit up, so I'm not listening to the radio anymore. But what I remember the reports indicating is that Don Miller, who's in pursuit, says possible shots fired. And Chris, you know, and we all know Chris is very clear about things, says negative, definite shots fired. This is radio.
You're right.
Chris tells me later that the sound was so loud that his ears were ringing. They had their windows down. So patrol car passes, our offender fires this round at close range. We think it went across their windshield, like it literally passed in front of their windshield. And we looked for the round later. We were never able to find it. So that happens. The next car in line also responding is the acting shift supervisor, another legendary ranger named Keith Loeber. So Keith is driving the car that I normally drive. It's a 1991 Chevy Caprice. And, you know, it's sort of my pride and joy. I take really good care of it. So this plays into the story because Keith, if you know Keith, Keith is anything but not aggressive. He's very assertive. He's very confident. He's a great person to be the acting supervisor. He cuts across the road to cut off our suspect who's coming right at him. And he's going to try to, you know, sort of block his path forward and there'd be nowhere for him to go. It's the road between the shrine and the general office. It's about a half mile of, there's no buildings. It's just a roadway. So Keith tells me later that he didn't want to fully cut him off because he didn't want there to be a collision because he was driving my car. So what I think I remember about that is I was happy Keith didn't do that because I believe there would have been a gunfight like right there.
Yeah.
Our offenders are already firing rounds. Mm-hmm. You know, the action reaction. I mean, I'm glad for Keith that, you know, though I think he might have gotten the better of him, that would have been a very dangerous situation. It would have played out right there. So our offender drives around Keith, drives into a ditch and gets around him. So now he's heading once again westbound into the main village. And he gets to where the general offices are and the Altamar is. It's a one-way loop road. There's a train station if you've been there. Again, it's heavily trafficked. There's people. It's Friday night. So now he's on the one-way section of the road. Reports later indicate that in a road that I think has a 25 mile per hour speed limit, that the speeds are about 70. He's got Ranger Don Miller behind him. He's got Ranger John Piasek and Chris Forbes behind him, and he's got Ranger Keith Loeber behind there. And another ranger who was on shift, John Hale, had heard the chase happen. He had driven out Center Road because this is a loop, thinking if the guy went the other way from Babbitt's, he'd cut him off. So John is a little bit out of position, but he's now made a U-turn and he's heading back in to get into the fight. So we've got four units actively engaging this guy, who he thought he was in the middle of nowhere in a national park.
Right.
Five officers who, you know, are well equipped and well trained for the era, directly engaging it. He gets down to an intersection where the road makes a sharp turn. And in the summer, there's a gate because the shuttle buses are only allowed up West Rim Drive. And it's, a 4 or 5 mile dead end road that in the summer isn't open to regular traffic, but it's got a gate. So during this part of the chase, I remember I read this and I think I was told this, the suspect either doesn't know the gate's there or doesn't care, but he drives into the gate and he drives through the gate. So the gate swings open and it swings open for him to get through and his swing stays open long enough for Ranger Don Miller to also get through and not hit the gate. So now they're going up West Rim Drive, and it goes up a hill. It's windy. You've got the rim on one side to the north. You've got trees and hills to your left, but it's a windy road and it goes up. So as pursuits often happen, the suspect gets a couple of corners ahead of Don. You know, you're trying to concentrate on what you're doing.
Right.
You've got a guy who's fired shots. You know that. And the other part of the story I thought that was interesting that Don reported later was that he thought, and I think it's here, it could have been earlier, but the interior light of the car was coming on, like it's flickering on and off.
Oh.
Well, what is actually happening is what our offender thinks that he needs to do is fire his weapon over his shoulder through the back window at Don. So he shoots out the back window at the pursuing ranger.
Wow.
Now, and again, what I remember is, and if Don was here, he could tell the story much better than me. Don isn't aware at the time that's what that is. But that's, you know, later we we've got the broken window, and we can reconstruct that. So up West Rim Drive, again, I believe probably a half mile, Don comes around a corner and has our suspect stopped in the middle of the roadway, retrieving some kind of backpack out of the back. And the suspect stands in the roadway and fires. I thought it was two rounds, but stuff I read says it was one. But he fires what we believe are the last rounds that he's got. It's a six-shot revolver.
Oh, yeah.
And I think he's probably emptied his revolver. And he runs, which it's downhill, but it's into the woods. So Don has stopped at this point. Arriving rangers stack up behind him, and they wouldn't know that the people in the car initially are hostages. So they've just got other people in the car. So they have to clear the car and deal with
them
while our suspect is running in the woods. So they very quickly discover that these people are hostages. And by now there's, you know, units responding, you know, like I'm getting dressed and looking for an available patrol vehicle. We're calling out the world. All sorts of people were responding. The radio is pretty busy. And we're trying to establish containment. But I just want to stop the story here just for a second. What I think we had at this moment of this fugitive's criminal spree, which you laid out very well in telling the story, was he met five law enforcement park rangers who, you know, collectively with Don Miller being in the lead, you know, engaged in what I would only say is, you know, heroic actions, courage, valor.
Right.
They were aggressive.
Yeah.
They were facing danger. And even though they didn't realize it, they were doing a hostage rescue.
Yeah.
They chased a very dangerous, very violent bad guy. He chased him into the woods. They ended his voyage. So everything that happens after this story, like he's like at a disadvantage because who he happened to meet and when it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And the era, 1992, you know, yes, we've got FLETC training, but everyone in this chase, I want to point this out also, none of them have been through FLETC at this point. They're all seasonal.
Fairly new. Yeah.
Oh, no, actually, so Lober, I back this up. Lober has been to FLETC. He's permanent. He's the only permanent on duty. So Lober has been, but the other four haven't. But they're extremely capable. They all went on to do great things in their careers, but they haven't had the advantage of the full training that we offered in those days. I think FLETC probably was 15 weeks in those days. But other things that don't exist in 1992, we don't equip our cop cars with push bumpers. We don't have what we call now pit training, you know, where we train if they're slow enough. You come up, touch, turn, accelerate, brake, you spin the car out. We don't carry road spikes with us back in those days. We essentially pursued dangerous people, and either, you know, one of four things happened. They crash. We lose sight of them. We stop chasing them because we can't, or we don't want to anymore, or they stop and they surrender. That's how police chases went in those days. So that's what they're faced with. They don't have a lot of tools in their toolbox. So back to the story. They've come to a stop. They've rescued the hostages. A bunch of resources are responding. By the time I actually get involved, get a patrol vehicle, get suited up, pick up Christopher Gill, who's the other shift supervisor, the other shift, and we respond to the scene, we've already got some containment at the gate intersection where he crashed onto West Rim Drive. But what our offender has done is what anybody can do at night is we believe has literally walked down the roadway, you know, alongside the roadway between trees. And so he's using the roadway to walk downhill as we're driving uphill. I probably passed him.
Yeah. I mean, didn't even
given
know
the,
it.
Given
yeah.
the, so, the incident starts to spin up. We take over what we call Ranger Operations, which is the headquarters of the South Rim. That becomes the incident command center. And, you know, we're working fast and furiously to get organized as resources are responding from everywhere. And we're establishing roadblocks, containment. Mutual aid is requested from the Coconino Sheriff and Flagstaff, Arizona PD. Their SWAT team responds. This is like an 80-mile response for them. So, again, back to, you know, search and principles of such. you know, you have to establish your search area, and you really would like your suspect you're looking for to be in that search area. By the time we get flagged, PD's SWAT guys, you know, embedded, and we have containment between what is called Rowell Road and West Rim Drive, I'm pretty sure he's out of the search area. And the paved trail that goes along the rim at Grand Canyon that takes you up to Bright Angel Lodge, El Tovar, out towards out towards the rim. Anyway, what I think has happened is, you know, he's basically exited that area. Now he's just wandering around with everybody else. You know, he's actually watching the show. Arizona Department of Public Safety has it. It's dark. They have a helicopter there. They're lighting up the area. We've got, you know, roadblocks set up on South Entrance Road at Center Road. It's an intersection. And I think we got a roadblock set up on East Rim Drive. And we have all sorts of activity in the village, including the helicopter. What I think later happens is he just watches the helicopter to figure out where we are.
Yeah,
and that gives him a vector point as where we're looking. You know, they're using FLIR night vision and also running a spotlight. A little sub part of the story is during this initial stage, the helicopter, either we have a sighting of him or a maybe sighting, and I don't know if it was him, but the helicopter is hovering over a vehicle that's parked in the parking lot near the Bright Angel Lodge. Well, we later investigate that car because it was broken into, and we find evidence that indicates that our suspect was actually in that car trying to hotwire it with the helicopter right over the top of him.
Yeah. Wow.
And, you know, we don't know that at the time. And if I remember right, it takes a while with the volume of reports coming in to actually get investigators on that and sort of ground truth that vehicle. And that was probably an attempted break-in. Another thing that happens is a park visitor that's staying at, and I think it's the El Tovar with his family, is out, you know, it's a warm summer evening watching the show. And he strikes up a conversation with a guy who's standing next to him. And the conversation from the visitor is something like, with all this activity, I couldn't sleep, so I figured I'd just watch to see what's going on. Well, the guy that he strikes up a conversation says something like, well, I work out at Tucson and I can't get out there because of all this is going on and something like that. And so the guy says, well, I'll give you a ride out there.
Oh, no.
So he, and we know this from the park visitor. I don't think we know this from our offender. He gives our offender a ride.
Wow.
And so they drive out South Entrance Road and they approach our main roadblock checkpoint at Center Road and South, which is an intersection. And By then I'm the incident commander. I'm on the radio. We're giving people direction. We're starting to organize stuff. And one of the rangers at the roadblock says, I've got a vehicle. He might have said van, but either van or vehicle that's turning out of the line of cars. Because by then we're backing traffic up in every direction.
Yeah.
So there's lines of cars waiting to go through our roadblocks. And it's making a turn and it's going out. And so I give them directions to go after and, you know, make contact with that vehicle. Again, I don't know for sure, but I believe that was probably the vehicle because the telling of the guy, the visitor was, I'm not going to wait in traffic. I'm going to go back and I'm not giving you a ride. And he lets his passenger out. And by description and by timing, we believe that is our offender. That he got a ride from a guy and didn't get to the checkpoint. And who knows what would have happened.
Right.
But he got taken back and he got left off in the village. So now we have an event that sort of takes on a life of its own. All the things you described have already happened. So now all these resources in Arizona that we're looking for them are coming our way. And, you know, it is 1992, but one of the things the Park Service is way ahead of everybody else's incident command.
Yes.
The Grand Canyon is one of the busiest search and rescue environments in the Park Service. It's also got a very, you know, well-developed wildland program. It has a primary and a secondary helicopter. And, you know, there's the tempo of activity at Grand Canyon lends itself to people that know, even in 1992, they know ICS very well. They know how to organize things. And so That first night into the morning, into the day, we've organized a pretty complex fugitive operation just around ICS principles, or at least we think we have. We have resources coming. We're putting together shift plans every 12 hours. We have plans chief, and we essentially set up two ICS operations, one for the day period and one for the night period. And we're running basically 24 hours a day. We've got divisions, we've got sections, we've got strike teams, every resource you could think of in a fugitive that we mm-hmm. can request is yeah. either en route or there. You know, we've got agency of reps attached, FBI, the Sheriff's Department, the Border Patrol. We've got agency reps attached all over the place. We've got different specialty resources from Department of Corrections all over the country that have tracking resources. We've got the Border Patrol bringing their tracking resources from the Southwest border. But this is something that you think you know stuff. And so yeah. my stage in my career, I actually didn't know all the things that it would be really helpful to know. So I'd worked in ICS, but usually I was either the ops or incident command, but I really wasn't that adept in like actually the organization of it. So Paul Henry is the chief ranger at Joshua Tree, arrives, I believe, with his SET team, and we split the incident in half, and he's the incident commander on the day shift. I'm incident commander on night shift. And so the first thing Paul does very correctly is says, we might want to pause here and establish some incident objectives. So pretty fundamental thing when you're doing yeah. incident management, you might want to write your incident objectives up on the board. So we knew at this point we're trying to catch the bad guy. That's as far as we'd gotten with our incident objectives. But we hadn't actually written them. And so that one little lesson has stayed with me my entire
yeah, career. That's interesting.
Since then, when I've been involved in big incidents where I'm there and I'm able to say, let's go ahead and establish incident objectives. And that was good that Paul did that, and we paused and we did establish incident objectives. However, they were remarkably ambitious. They included maintaining visitor services and access to the park, you know, safety of the responders and the community, catching the bad guy. And I think catching the bad guy was number one. What we set ourselves up for was normal operations at the South Rim with a major manhunt, the largest manhunt in Arizona, going on right in the midst of that. And, you know, in retrospect, that's probably a bridge too far. It wasn't definitely my decision that we were going to do right. it that way, but that's yeah. how it played out. At one point, you know, we had dog teams that were working, and I didn't know that much about canine then, and now I know a lot more. I'm not sure that we were right, but at the time, our canine handlers and our teams believed that they were behind our suspect, our offender, by several hours or more. In other words, they're going through a neighborhood tracking, going up to houses and stuff, saying, and cars saying, he's been through here, this is what he's touched, this is where he's been. So their information is putting him inside our search area. So at one point early on in this incident, during the day operation, we marshaled every law enforcement resource we could get that wasn't assigned to something else. And it was just a sea of uniforms, Highway Patrol, Rangers, deputies, right. Flag PD, and we broke them up into strike teams of our member divisions, and we had as that assignment that operational period to visit every residence, every door where somebody would be, and do a welfare check to see if our.
Now, how much time has gone by here by the time Paul Henry gets there from Joshua Tree? I mean,
well, this Paul is gets there days, probably. Right? Paul gets there the next day. So this starts in an evening. Paul's there the next day.
Okay.
And so this thing I'm telling you about is probably a couple of days after that.
Okay.
And every day the incident is getting bigger. It's like your experience when you're on a wildland fire. Mm-hmm. And every day you come in from the field and you'll notice that the overhead parking lot has grown. You know, the overhead parking lot has jumped the line. Every day this thing is getting larger and larger. Yeah. We're calling in more resources, and we're unfortunately getting information that doesn't put him out of our search area.
Right. So he's in Grand Canyon for several days, right?
So, and our plans chief on my operational period, Ken Phillips, is very, very, you know, Ken's also a legendary ranger. Ken knows his stuff, and he has very correctly defined our search area. And one of the things we're very proud of in this incident is our suspect never left our Defiant search area until he eventually breaks out and escapes, which we'll get to in a little bit.
Yeah.
So our search area takes us out to the East Rim Drive to Desert View. It takes us down into the rim, Brangel Trail, and it takes us into the backcountry a little bit, and it covers the entire South Rim Village. That's our search area. And this searching, knocking on door, doing welfare check on everything happens. I put my my Ray Jack up in my window at my house and put a note saying, you know, incident management, asleep, don't wake me up, you know, because I knew they were going to knock on the door and I didn't want to wake up. Yeah. And I don't remember being woken up. Right. But here's the other part of the story that starts. You said, you know, where are we at? So you've experienced events where you're sleep deprived and fatigued, right?
Yep.
And so you initially have the adrenaline dump, but each day that goes on with the 12-hour operational period, which are really like about 14 or 15, like I'm getting a couple hours sleep in between. I'm trying to sleep during the day. So gradually I'm having less and less fun every day, experiencing extreme fatigue in the middle of something that has no end in sight.
Yeah.
And we still want to catch the bad guy. I think at one point we have 10 aircraft assigned to the incident. Another legendary park employee, Larry Nicky, who had been at the Grand Canyon, he's actually name requested from Olympic here in Port Angeles to come down and be our air ops manager. We've got rotor and fixed wing assigned to the incident, and we've got all sorts of aircraft flying and doing things. And I never saw them. I think they were staged out at our helibase, and some of them were out the South Rim Airport, but we've got a lot of resources attached to this thing. So We go all the way until early July with this thing spinning up every day, 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
People in the Altavar Hotel who are having, you know, dinner in a 5-star place get to see, you know, a tactical unit with canine come running through the
right
as they believe they're on a track.
Now, are the people told anything when they're coming
told
in?
Stuff. At that point? They're people are told something. I remember at one point park employees are told not to wear their uniforms if they don't have to. Like non-law enforcement employees are.
Yeah.
Because we know we have
hitchhikers.
There's a lot of information going out. Remember the ability to put out information is in its, you know, really,
apps.
You know, it's very crude compared to what we have now that we could push out. We've got his picture everywhere.
Yeah.
But he's a generic looking white man. Mm-hmm. That's the only way I could describe it.
Yeah.
A lot of people look just like our suspect. I mean, we're doing all sorts of things like putting people on in plain clothes on the shuttle buses to see if we can spot him. We believe he's hiding in plain sight. So we've got, you know, plain clothes deputies and rangers on the shuttle buses. Well, one deputy that I knew pretty well, if you looked at a picture of them and you look at a picture of our offender, they look almost exactly the same.
Wow.
And sure enough, someone reported our deputy to be a suspicious person. But back to fatigue and everything else.
Yeah.
At some point, when you've been looking at faces, everybody starts to look a lot like your suspect or not like your suspect. And our roadblocks and our checkpoints, we're doing everything from just visually letting people drive through and looking at them to actually stopping cars at night. We're stopping cars and inspecting every car, both directions,
yeah,
and backing up traffic for miles and miles, you know. But given the tempo of it and given the complexity, some lessons learned from later is the people doing the roadblocks aren't given a lot of instructions on exactly what to do, how to, you know, to maintain a database. You know, should you ask for identification if somebody looks suspicious, and actually establish that there are a real person.
Mm-hmm.
We don't do any of that. And that's going to come into the story later as well.
Okay.
Because we're trying to do too many things. That's how I would put it. We're literally trying to do too many things. And my FBI counterpart, who is very knowledgeable and very helpful, makes a strong point to me that the park should be closed, that you cannot sustain this. And he convinces me that I should pitch to park management to close down the park. And I actually make an attempt, but I'm not successful in that. You know, there's downsides to closing a park, you know, loss of business claims, things like that. It's not a simple task.
Right. I mean, it would be similar to clearing out a small city.
Right.
You know, how
in other park
that?
Areas that, you know, like later Yosemite, a year later on a manhunt closed down the Tuolumne Meadows area, Tioga Road. They evacuated the entire area and closed it. But it wasn't a very populated place.
Right.
You know,
right. Well, we did that in Yellowstone in the 88 fires when fires were coming over. I mean, that was very difficult to evacuate people who were already there. And, it's very difficult. Yeah, it's
very difficult to do it. However, I sort of get, you know, invest some energy in trying to make that happen, and it doesn't happen. So we continue with the, you know, the incident getting bigger every day, and we're still getting information that puts him in our search area. And so early July, and I remember this because my sheriff's department counterpart, who was a captain with Coconino County, we're riding in a car together not too far from the command post, and I hear Ranger Pat Buccello, another legendary ranger, come up on the radio. She's at a roadblock on East Rim Drive saying something to the effect that I've got two people here that report that our suspect has tried to kidnap them and actually carjacked and stole their vehicle. So that's an actual sighting. So we respond resources, aircraft, people to that location. You know, he's once again escaped into the woods. We later find the car abandoned. But that absolutely puts him in our search area.
Yeah.
Like, that's confirmed that he hasn't left. What we learned later was, is he was moving around, and at night he would work his way up to, like, the roadblocks and the checkpoints and could stand in the dark a couple feet away from people and just listen to what they were talking about, listen to their radio traffic, and try to figure out what we were doing.
Yeah. I also read that he would walk in circles to avoid.
He said that. That's possible. I don't know. I mean, I don't remember us establishing that, but I knew far less about canine than I know now. So, I mean, we were getting enough evidence from different trusted canine resources before the carjacking of the two people that I think we had solid evidence that he was in our area. But another part of the story was Desert View is about 25 miles out to the east. It's the edge of our search area. It's still in our search area, but the edge. Mm-hmm. We established during this time that he got himself out to Desert View. He broke into the SAR cache out there and raided supplies from our own ranger SAR cache.
It's very bold.
Yeah, very bold. Broke in, got in. And then he brought himself back into our search area. Into our inner perimeter.
Interesting.
Back in. And so he does the attempted kidnapping early July, not successful, drives away in a vehicle, dumps it in the woods, but he's still inside our area. So July 4th, and I didn't remember this, but I read this, he, in roughly the same area, approaches two British nationals who were tourists and takes them hostage. So takes them hostage at gunpoint. They're driving a rental Nissan Sentra. And so I believe he's calculated that because it's July 4th, we would have had to scale down our search. That I think he said this later in statements he made, that he believed, you know, and this is fascinating to me. This is the offender perceptual shorthand. Mm-hmm. He believes that there's no way we could keep doing this, right? Started on June 26th. There's no way we could still be doing it. So he drives himself into the inner perimeter with his hostages. He passes a roadblock that's just doing visual inspections on East Rim Drive. So now he's inside our inner perimeter. So he drives in with his hostages, gets past, I think it's a checkpoint managed by Arizona Highway Patrol, if I remember right. But anyway, it's law enforcement. So now he's inside. So he drives out. And if you've been to the Grand Canyon, this is East Rim Drive becomes South Entrance Road. And it's south. So he passes a checkpoint at South Entrance Road, almost to Tucson, where they stop him. And it's deputies and rangers combined. They're working in a roadblock. And they've been working for days and days and days on end and suffering the same kind of fatigue that we all are. But he's gotten out of the car. He's sitting in the back seat. And what I remember was he's wearing a ball cap. I have no idea how he would have... You know, he wouldn't have been taking a shower. Okay. So he would be pretty grubby looking.
Yeah.
And he's got these two women in the front seat. But you remember the people involved in this incident haven't been given any instructions on what to do.
Right.
Like, so they get him out of the car. They check the trunk as I remember, they talk to him. And I think somebody even says, yeah, you look just like our guy. He gets back in the car, and we believe he was armed and probably carrying a weapon on his person at that time. So would he have got into a shootout with them? You know, you're all standing mm-hmm. around close quarters. He's outnumbered. Right. I don't know. But obviously that's an extremely dangerous situation that they were in. But he goes back in the car, he heads out, and then there's one more checkpoint he passes, manned by the higher patrol, down outside the park. So now he's out of our search area. So he's left. So this is day 10, I think.
This is the 4th of July, isn't it?
Yeah, so we're into day 9 or day 10.
Wow.
Okay. So you can just do the math from the 26th. I guess that's day 9. But he's out of the search area. And it's about 70 miles from South Rim down to Williams, Arizona. So he drives his hostages to a location. And I read that he tied them to a tree, dumped their luggage out, and now he's got their car. And now he's home free. He's left the largest manhunt in Arizona's history. He's left an operation. At that point, I was told we had 800 resources assigned to the incident. So he's left the incident. So he gets on I-40. He's heading eastbound, and he's probably driving above the speed limit. But he comes upon an Arizona DPS, which is Highway Patrol, comes across a trooper in a Mustang that's marked. It's obviously that it's a trooper Mustang. But that officer is not involved in this incident. He's simply traveling eastbound on I-40. So what our offender thinks he needs to do, again, back to the perceptual shorthand.
Right. You know,
they don't always make decisions based on fact. What he thinks he needs to do is drive up alongside him and shoot out his passenger window at the cruiser. So he puts I remember it being a couple of rounds into the trooper's car, into the, like,
wow.
the trunk area.
And was the trooper sitting? He was sitting in the car.
He's driving.
Right?
Well, he's driving.
He
gets a surprise attack from this guy.
Yeah.
And puts a couple rounds into his car. And I think he's pretty well aware that that's probably our guy. So now the chase starts on I-40, and units are responding from everywhere.
Yeah.
It goes on to South Interstate 17. And the trooper is still, I think, the only one in the chase. He exits the interstate. They've probably gone 30 miles at this point and has some kind of traffic collision. And the last thing the trooper sees is our offender is running away from him as the trooper is firing a shotgun at him.
Wow.
Very, very appropriately firing a yeah. shotgun at him. And I think at this point we know it's our bad guy. So the resources we have at the South Rim are already being demobed. I think already, but a bunch of them leave, but the incident doesn't leave. Like we don't, incident management doesn't move down there. We essentially disband the incident management, and the offender makes his way into a community. I think it's West Sedona. In other words, he actually travels pretty far and gets himself down into West Sedona, where on the evening after that pursuit, he's spotted by a resident at his garden hose in the back. And I've read that they actually had words, like he actually talked to the guy, and he's drinking from his garden yeah. hose. And so the resources we had at the South Rim are still involved. And one of those was U.S. Border Patrol from, the Southwest Arizona border.
Right.
So U.S. Border Patrol and Yavapai Sheriff's deputies respond to this location. And again, what I remember about the reports was that he was hiding under a deck and they take him into custody. Stuff I read, it kind of has it a little different, but he surrenders essentially yeah. to that incident. He's taken into custody. And there's famous pictures of him being led away by Yavapai and Coconino County deputies with a big smile on his face. And in the picture, he's handcuffed in front with a belly chain. And it just he's handcuffed in front. And,
yeah.
you know, there's this press picture and he's got a really big smile. You know, he's reportedly told the sheriff of the county that he really enjoyed it. It was a fun chase. And the prosecutor we have at the time in Coconino County, county prosecutor, is somebody who we work with later as an assistant U.S. attorney. And she's now the U.S. magistrate at the South Rim. She mm-hmm. works very hard to get him prosecuted. for the crimes he's committed and also extradited to California for murder. The United States attorney won't take the case as a federal felony on the Rangers.
Like assaults on the officers.
Yeah, really. They won't. So they defer that to local prosecutors at the time. I don't agree with that because I feel really strongly about what happened. And, you know, there's a lot of aftermath on these incidents that it takes me months to recover from sleep and fatigue and stress, the physical impacts. And, you know, the immediate involved Rangers who, you know, who I believe they're heroes. The only way to describe them. I write them up for Valor Awards, and I don't get approval for those awards to go beyond the park level.
Too bad.
So we award them, you know, the highest awards we give them in the park level. But I think nowadays those would go to DOI and those would be Valor Awards. But at the time that doesn't happen. Ranger Don Miller takes it upon himself to organize a trip to Texas, and he may have had another ranger accompany him. I don't want to get that part wrong, but he awards the young man that ran and alerted him.
Oh, good. He was 15 or 16 years old.
Yeah. As a young, I think he was a junior high school kid, I thought, but he in Texas in person in his hometown, and it's covered by the newspaper there, awards him an award. I thought that was just like awesome.
I
think we paid for the trip. We, you know, we put him on travel and we did it. And afterwards, and you've seen some of it, different media outlets tried to sort of tell the story, but the story is so complicated and it's got so many moving parts that I've never seen any coverage of it that really does it justice. I read one recently that comes close, but it's got so many details wrong that I know are wrong. I'm not sure what to make of the parts that I wasn't there for. A retired colleague of mine and good friend who's a writer in 2008 did a FOIA request on this case. And so he was able to get all the original documents. Incident action plans, reports, all that stuff. So the historical material is safe should someone someday want to write a book or actually you know, dive into it, read the story.
Well, I'm thinking Hulu needs to pay you another phone call and
that would be wonderful. And I think if nothing else, all that historical stuff should live in an archive.
So exactly.
100 years now, historians could tell the story. And, you know, it's like you told the beginning part, you know, the, you know, truth is definitely stranger than fiction.
Yeah.
And, you know, things happen everywhere, including national parks. And the something that's happening remotely in Arizona all of a sudden winds up in the middle of, you know, one of our premier national parks.
One of the things that I always say is sometimes, but for the criminals coming into a national park to commit their crime, they may have otherwise continued to get away with things. And I think this is a good example. While he wasn't captured in Grand Canyon, I think that went a long way to his exhaustion and actual surrender.
I absolutely agree with you. And I believe his demise started when he entered Grand Canyon. Like, number one, his little kidnapping hostage scheme was foiled.
Yeah. And several times over.
Yeah, several times over. And he was able to walk, you know, hide in plain sight for a while. His ability to navigate was, you know, disrupted. And like the story ends with him firing at a trooper on the interstate who has nothing to do with the incident.
Right.
And there's a couple other parts of the story that like, you know, that for me, I'm not sure exactly why they happened. But if you think about that era, 1992, you know, victim witness practices and trainings were not very evolved.
Right.
And I have no idea what we did for the kidnapping victims at Grand Canyon. I mean, I was not aware at the time of Coconino County having any victim witness coordinators that we work with. Like I never worked with any of them, even though I dealt with violent crime all the time. Yeah. I don't know what we did for those people at all. The federal laws came in the late 80s. So those were already existed in Arizona. I don't know. Maybe not.
Right.
But the federal laws were already there. But we didn't have the tools like the job that you later took Had you been working in your job, you would have been on scene at the incident with other resources.
With all the victims, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And I know this happened, and I don't think Don Miller would mind me saying this. Like, the suspect was allowed, the offender was allowed to be his own attorney. So he was allowed to interview witnesses during the state trial. And so Don,
that's terrible,
had to go and be interviewed by this guy. And I was not able to stop that. I think today I would be able to stop that.
Right.
Like, a guy that shot at a ranger,
yeah,
who's being prosecuted, doesn't get to sit in a jail cell as his own attorney and interview him.
Yeah.
The answer is no.
Yeah.
But at the time, we couldn't stop it. It happened. And he interviewed a couple of other key witnesses one-on-one. I mean, if that's not intimidation, I don't know what
exactly.
It is. And I know that he gets to have access in some form, like for depositions and such, but I was not happy about that when that happened. I've never heard of that since then, where an offender is able to do that, you know, sit face to face with somebody that he victimized and ask them questions and interview them.
That's interesting to me, because I know he did admit to, and I think it was, he pled guilty to.
Yeah. He did.
All the kidnapping and all the other bank robberies and all the other things he did on his crime spree. But the one thing he would never plead to was the murder and dismemberment from the McAuliffe case.
But they did extradite. Too,
yeah. Right. But they did extradite him. He did have a trial. He was found guilty and sentenced to death. And I believe he still sits on death row.
So last I heard, he's at San Quentin Prison on death row.
Yep.
Which is Larkspur, California, Marin County is where San Quentin is. And that's the town I'm from.
Oh, interesting.
And when I grew up there, I mean, I could look out at the bay, Richmond Bridge, and I could see San Quentin Prison. But
well, good.
The story has some good endings. And there was a lot of, I think, lessons learned later for other events in the Park Service that we all absorbed. You know, a lot of good came out of this, you know, things that can be done, you know, better. And in the modern world with phone apps and artificial intelligence and drones and things that we can deploy, tactical trackers, like, you remember the tactical tracking team we had at Yellowstone?
Absolutely.
Yeah. If we had been able to put just that team, you know, that Bruce Applin led,
right,
trackers out there with the Rangers and the agents, I mean, we might have, you know, he was leaving tracks of him and the trackers. If we had had them there and used them to the modern standard, we might have got him that way.
Right. You know, it doesn't sound like he was the survivalist he claimed to be. And yet he never really left the roadway very far. And I do believe that probably would have gone a long way to end his crime spree a little earlier.
It was definitely an adventure that I'm glad I was a part of. You know, I am exceedingly proud of the patrol rangers that engaged him and rescued the hostages. They're heroes, and you know, they did some remarkable work that really ended this guy's crime spree.
Yeah, this is one of those stories you just can't make up.
Right.
And that's all for our case today. And thanks again, Brian, so much for.
Well, thank you, Tara.
That's an amazing story. And I know you have more stories. So I'm hoping you'll come back, or even your other legendary wife. I know she has a story or two. So
she does.
I'd love to invite her. I would love to invite her on. So anyway, we'll just go ahead and say goodbye and watch out for the company you keep.
Thanks. Thank you for your work, Tara. Great talking to you.
Hey, before you go, we'd love to hear from you. Please visit our website at www.crimeoffthegrid.com and send us a story suggestion or leave a comment at crimeoffthegrid@gmail.com.